The Cave of the Ancients by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read to you by Blue Friend, October 2016. Chapter 4. This season was that of Logsar, the Tibetan New Year. We Chelas, and Trappas also, had been busy for some time now, making butter images. Last year we had not bothered, and had therefore occasioned some ill feeling. Other Lamasaries had held to the belief, correctly, that we of Shakpori had neither time nor interest for such childish pursuits. This year, then, by order of the Inmost One himself, we had to make butter images and enter the contest. Our effort was a modest one, compared to that of some Lamasaries. On a wooden framework some 20 feet high by 30 feet long, we were molding, in colored butter, various scenes from the sacred books. Our figures were fully three-dimensional, and we hoped that when seen by the light of the flickering butter lamps, there would be an illusion of movement. The Inmost One himself and all the senior lamas viewed the exhibits every year, and much praise was accorded the builders of the winning effort. After the season of Logsar, the butter was melted down and used in the butter lamps throughout the year. As I worked, I had some skill in modeling. I thought of all that I had learned during the past few months. Certain things about religion still puzzled me, and I resolved to ask my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup, about them at the first opportunity. But now butter sculpture was the thing. I stooped and scraped up a fresh load of flesh-colored butter and carefully climbed up the scaffolding so that I could build up the ear to Buddha-like proportions. Off to my right, two young chelas were having a butter ball fight, scooping up handloads of butter, molding the stuff roughly round, then throwing that messy missile at the enemy. They were having a great time. Unfortunately, a monk proctor appeared round a stone pillar to see what all the noise was about. Without a word, he seized both boys, one in his right hand and the other in his left, and threw them both into a great vat of warm butter. I turned and got on with my work. Butter mixed with lamp black formed very suitable eyebrows. Already there was illusion of life in the figure. This is the world of illusion, after all, I thought. Down I climbed and walked across the floor so that I could obtain a better impression of the work. The master of the arts smiled upon me. I was, perhaps, his favorite pupil, as I liked modeling and painting, and really worked to learn from him. "We are doing well, Lobsang," he said pleasantly. "The gods look alive." He walked away in order that he could direct alterations to another part of the scene, and I thought, the gods look alive. Are there gods? Why are we taught about them if there are none? I must ask my guide. Thoughtfully, I scraped the butter from my hands. Over in the corner, two cellas who had been thrown into the warm butter were trying to get themselves clean by rubbing their bodies with fine brown sand, looking very foolish indeed as they rubbed away. I chuckled and turned to go. A heavy-set cella walked beside me and remarked, "Even the gods must have laughed at that." Even the gods, even the gods, even the gods, the refrain echoed through my mind in time with my footsteps. The gods, were there gods? I walked on down to the temple and settled myself, waiting for the familiar service to commence. Hear the voices of our souls, all you who wander. This is the world of illusion. Life is but a dream. All that are born must die. The priest's voice droned on, reciting the well-known words, words which now struck at my curiosity. The third stick of incense is lit to summon a wandering ghost that he may be guided. Not helped by the gods, I thought, but guided by his fellow men. Why not by the gods? Why did we pray to our overself and not to a god? The rest of the service had no attraction, no meaning for me. I was jolted out of my thoughts by an elbow digging violently into my ribs. "Lobsang, Lobsang, what is the matter with you? Are you dead? Get up, the service is over." I stumbled to my feet and followed the others out of the temple. "Sir," I said to my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondop, some hours later, "Sir, is there a god or gods?" He looked down at me and said, "Let us go and sit on the roof, Lobsang. We can hardly talk here in this crowded place." He turned and led the way along the corridor, out through the Lama's quarters, up the notched pole, and so onto the roof. For a moment we stood looking at the well-loved scene, the towering mountain ranges, the bright water of the Ki Chu, and the reed-girt Kaling Chu. Beneath us, the Norbu Linga, or Jewel Park, showed as a mass of living green. My guide waved his hand. "Do you think all this is by chance, Lobsang?" "Of course there is a god." We moved to the highest part of the roof and sat down. "You are confused in your thinking, Lobsang," stated my guide. "There is a god. There are gods. While upon this earth, we are in no position to appreciate the form and nature of God. We live in what may be termed a three-dimensional world. God lives in a world so far removed that the human brain, while on earth, cannot hold the necessary concept of God, and thus men tend to rationalize. God is assumed to be something human, superhuman, if you prefer the term, but man, in his conceit, believes that he is made in the image of God. Man also believes that there's no life on other worlds. If man is made in the image of God, and the peoples of other worlds are in a different image, What is to become of our concept that man only is made in God's image? The Lama looked keenly at me to make sure that I was following his remarks. Most certainly I was. All this appeared self-evident. Every world, every country of every world, has its God or guardian angel. We call the God in charge of the world the Manu. He's a highly evolved spirit, a human who, through incarnation after incarnation, has purged the dross, leaving only the pure behind. There is a band of great beings who at times of need come to this earth that they may set an example whereby ordinary mortals may be enabled to lift from the mire of worldly desires. I nodded my head. I knew about this. Knew that Buddha, Moses, Christ, and many others were of that order. I knew also of Maitreya, who, it is stated in the Buddhist scriptures, will come to the world 5,656 million years after the passing of Buddha, or Gautama, as he should more accurately be named. All this and more was part of our standard religious teaching, as was the knowledge that any good person had an equal chance, no matter what name his own religious belief carried. We never believed that only one religious sect went to heaven, and all others were tumbled down to hell for the amusement of sundry sanguinary fiends. But my guide was ready to continue. We have the Manu of this world, the great evolved being who controls the destiny of the world. There are minor Manus who control the destiny of a country. In endless years, the world Manu will move on, and the next best, now well-trained, will evolve, will take over the earth. Ah! I exclaimed in some triumph, then not all Manus are good. The Manu of Russia is allowing Russians to act against our good. The Manu of China permits the Chinese to raid our borders and kill our people. The Lama smiled across at me. You forget, Lobsang, he replied. This world is hell. We come here to learn lessons. We come here to suffer, that our spirit may evolve. Hardship teaches. Pain teaches. Kindness and consideration do not. There are wars in order that men may show courage on the battlefields and, like iron ore in the furnace, be tempered and strengthened by the fire of battle. The flesh body does not matter, Lobsang. This is only a temporary puppet. The soul, the spirit, the overself, call it what you will, is all that need be considered. On earth, in our blindness, we think that the body alone matters. Fear that the body may suffer clouds our outlook and warps our judgment. We have to act for the good of our own overselves while still assisting others. Those who follow blindly the dictates of overbearing parents add a load to the parents as well as to themselves. Those who blindly follow the dictates of some stereotyped religious belief also cramp their evolution. "Honorable Lama," I expostulated, "may I add two comments?" "Yes, you may," replied my guide. "You said that we learn more quickly if conditions are harsh. I would prefer a little more kindness. I could learn that way." He looked thoughtfully at me. "Could you?" he asked. "Would you learn the sacred books even if you did not fear the teachers? Would you do your share in the kitchens if you did not fear punishment if you lazed? Would you?" I hung my head. It was right. I worked in the kitchens when ordered to. I studied the sacred books because I feared the result of failure. "And your next question?" asked the Lama. "Well, sir, how does a stereotype religion injure one's evolution?" "I'll give you two examples," replied my guide. "The Chinese believed that it did not matter what they did in this life, as they could pay for faults and sins when they came again. Thus, they adopted a policy of mental slothfulness. Their religion became as an opiate and drugged them into spiritual laziness. They lived only for the next life, and so their arts and crafts fell into disuse. China thus became a third-rate power, in which bandit warlords started a reign of terror and pillage. I had noticed that the Chinese in Lhasa seemed to be unnecessarily brutal and quite fatalistic. Death to them meant nothing more than passing to another room. I did not fear death in any way, but I wanted to get my task finished in one lifetime instead of slacking and having to come to this world time after time. The process of being born, being a helpless baby, having to go to school, all that to me was trouble. I hoped that this life would be my last on earth. The Chinese had had wonderful inventions, wonderful works of art, a wonderful culture. Now, through too slavishly adhering to a religious belief, the Chinese people had become decadent, a ready prey to communism. At one time, age and learning had been deeply respected in China, as should be the case now. No more were the sages given the honor due them. All that mattered now was violence, personal gain, and selfishness. "Labsang," the voice of my guide broke into my thoughts, "we have seen a religion which taught inaction, which taught that one should not in any way influence another in case one added to one's own karma the debt which passes on from life to life." He looked out across the city of Lhasa, seeing our peaceful valley, then turned to me again. "Religions of the West tend to be very militant. People there are not content to believe what they want to believe, but they are willing to kill others to make them believe the same." "I don't see how killing a person would be a good religious practice," I remarked. "No, Lobsang," replied the Lama, But in the time of the Spanish Inquisition, one branch of Christians tortured any other branch in order that they might be converted and saved. People were stretched on the rack and burned at the stake, that they might thus be persuaded to change their belief. Even now these people send out missionaries who try by almost any means to obtain converts. It seems that they are so unsure of their belief that they must have others express approval and agreement of their religion, on the lines, presumably, that there is safety in numbers. "Sir," I said, "do you think people should follow a religion?" "Why, certainly, if they so desire," replied Lama Mingyur Dondup. "If people have not yet reached the stage where they can accept the Overself and the Manu of the world, then it may be a comfort for them to adhere to some formal system of religion. It is a mental and spiritual discipline. It makes some people feel that they belong within a family group, with a benevolent father watching over them, and a compassionate mother ever ready to intercede on their behalf with the father. Yes, for those in a certain stage of evolution, such religion is good. But the sooner such people realize that they should pray to their Overself, the sooner will they evolve. We are sometimes asked why we have sacred images in our temples, or why we have temples at all. To that we can reply that such images are reminders that we too can evolve and in time become high spiritual beings. As for our temples, they are places where people of like mind may congregate for the purpose of giving mutual strength in the task of reaching one's Overself. By prayer, even when that prayer be not properly directed, one is able to reach a higher rate of vibration. Meditation and contemplation within a temple, a synagogue, or a church is beneficial. I mused upon that which I had just heard. Below us, the Kaling Chu tinkled and ran faster as it squeezed to crowd itself beneath the bridge of the Lingkor Road. Off to the south, I perceived a party of men waiting for the ferryman of the Kai Chu. Traders had come earlier in the day, bringing papers and magazines for my guide. Papers from India and from strange countries of the world. The Lama Mingyur Dondup had traveled far and often and kept in close touch with affairs outside Tibet. Papers, magazines, I had a thought at the back of my mind, something that had bearing on this discussion. Papers. Suddenly I jumped as if stung. Not papers, but a magazine. Something I had seen. Now, what was it? I knew. It was all clear to me. I had flicked over some pages, not understanding a single word of the foreign languages, but seeking pictures. One such page had stopped beneath my questing thumb. The picture of a winged being hovering in the clouds, hovering above a field of bloody battle. My guide, to whom I had shown the picture, had read and translated for me the caption. Honorable Lama, I explained excitedly, earlier today you told me of that figure. You called it the Angel of Mons, which many men claim to see above a battlefield. Was that a god? No, Lobsang, replied my guide. Many, many men, in the hour of their desperation, long to see the figure of a saint, or as they term it, an angel. Their urgent need and strong emotions inherent in a battlefield gave strength to their thoughts, their desires, and their prayers. Thus, in the manner of which I have shown you, they formed a thought form to their own specifications. As the first ghostly outline of a figure appeared, the prayers and thoughts of the men who caused it were intensified, and so the figure gained in strength and solidity and persisted for an appreciable time. We do the same thing here when we raise thought forms in the inner temple. But come, Lobsang, the day is far advanced, and the ceremonies of Lhagsar are not yet concluded. We walk down the corridor, down into the scene of bustle, the busy turmoil which was the everyday life within a lamasery during a season of celebration. The master of the arts came in search of me, wanting a small, light boy to climb the scaffold and make some alterations to the head of a figure at the top. Trailing in the master's wake, I followed him at a brisk pace down the slippery path to the butter room. I donned an old robe, one liberally coated with colored butter, and tying a light line around my waist that I might haul up material, I climbed the scaffold. It was as the master had surmised. Part of the head had broken away from the wooden slats. Calling down what I wanted, I dangled my rope and pulled up a pail of butter. For some hours I worked, twisting slivers of thin wood around the struts of the backing, molding once again the butter to hold the head in place. At long last, the master of the arts, watching critically from the ground, indicated that he was satisfied. Slowly, stiffly, I disentangled myself from the scaffolding and slowly descended to the ground. Thankfully, I changed my robe and hurried off. The next day, I and many other cellas were down on the plain of Lhasa at the foot of the Patala by the village of Sho. In theory, we were watching the processions, the games, and the races. In actuality, we were showing off in front of the humble pilgrims who thronged the mountain paths that might be in Lhasa at the time of Lhagsar. From all over the Buddhist world they came, to this, the Mecca of Buddhism. Old men crippled with age, young women carrying small babies, all came in the belief that in completing the holy circuit of the city and the Patala, they were atoning for past sins and ensuring a good rebirth to the next life on earth. Fortune tellers thronged the Lingkor Road. Ancient beggars whined for alms, and traders with their goods suspended from their shoulders pushed their way through the throngs in search of customers. Soon I tired of the frenzied scene, tired of the gaping multitude and their endless inane questions. I slipped away from my companions and slowly wandered up the mountain path to my lamastic home. Upon the roof, in my favorite spot, all was quiet. The sun provided a gentle warmth. From below me, now out of sight, there arose a confused murmur from the crowds, a murmur which, in its indistinctness, soothed me and made me drowse in the noonday heat. A shadowy figure materialized almost at the extreme limit of my vision. Sleepily I shook my head and blinked my eyes. When I again opened them, the figure was still there, clearer now and glowing, more dense. The hairs at the back of my neck rose in sudden fright. "You are not a ghost," I exclaimed. "Who are you?" The figure smiled slightly and replied, "No, my son, I'm not a ghost. Once I too studied here at the Shakpori and lazed as you're lazing now upon this roof. Then I desired, above all, to speed my liberation from earthly desires. I had myself immured within the walls of that hermitage." He gestured upwards, and I turned to follow the direction of his outstretched arm. "Now," he continued telepathically, "on this, the 11th Logsar, since that date, I have attained that which I sought, freedom to roam at will, while leaving my body safe within the hermitage cell. My first journey is to here, that I may once again gaze upon the crowd, that I may once again visit this well-remembered spot. Freedom, boy, I have attained freedom." Before my gaze he vanished like a cloud of incense dispersed by the night wind. The hermitages. We Chelas had heard so much about them. What were they like inside? We often wondered. Why did men incarcerate themselves within those rock chambers, perched precariously upon the mountain's edge? We wondered about that, too. I determined that I would ask my beloved guide. Then I remembered that an old Chinese monk lived a few yards from where I was. Old Wu Xi had had an interesting life. For some years he'd been a monk attached to the palace of the emperors in Peking. Tiring of such life, he had wandered into Tibet in search of enlightenment. Eventually, he had reached the Shakpori and had been accepted. Tiring of that, after a few years, he had gone to a hermitage and for 7 years had lived a solitary life. Now, though, he was back at Shakpori waiting to die. I turned and hastened to the corridor below. Making my way to a small cell, I called to the old man. "Come in, come in," he called, in a high, quavering voice. I entered his cell and for the first time met Wu Xi, the Chinese monk. He was sitting cross-legged, and in spite of his age, his back was as straight as a young bamboo. He had high cheekbones and very, very yellow, parchment-like skin. His eyes were jet black and slanted. A few straggly hairs grew from his chin, and from his upper lip depended a dozen or so hairs of his long mustache. His hands were yellow-brown and mottled with great age, while his veins stood out like the twigs of a tree. As I walked towards him, he peered blindly in my direction, sensing rather than seeing. He said, "A boy, a young boy from the way you walk. What do you want, boy?" "Sir," I replied, "you lived for a long time in a hermitage. Will you, holy sir, have the goodness to tell me of it?" He mumbled and chewed at the ends of his mustache and then said, "Sit, boy. It is long since I have talked of the past, although I think of it constantly now." "When I was a boy," he said, "I traveled far and went to India. There I saw the hermits encloistered within their caves, and some of them appeared to have attained enlightenment." He shook his head. "The ordinary people were very lazy, spending their days beneath the trees. It was a sad sight." "Holy sir," I interrupted, "I should much prefer to hear of the hermitages of Tibet." "Eh, what's that?" he asked feebly. "Oh yes, the hermitages of Tibet. I returned from India and went to my native Peking. Life there bored me, for I was not learning. I took again my staff and bowl and made my way over many months to the borders of Tibet. I sighed to myself in exasperation." The old man continued, "In the course of time, having stayed at lamasery after lamasery, always in search of enlightenment, I reached Shakpuri. The abbot permitted me to stay here as I qualified as a physician in China. My specialty was acupuncture. For a few years I was content. Then I conceived a great desire to enter a hermitage." By now I was almost dancing with impatience. If the old man took much longer, I should be too late. I could not miss evening service. Even as I thought of it, I could hear the first boomings of the gongs. Reluctantly, I rose to my feet and said, "Respected sir, I have to go now." The old man chuckled. "No, boy," he replied, "you may stay. For are you not here receiving instructions from an elder brother? Stay, you are excused from evening service." I seated myself again, knowing that he was correct, although he was still a Trapa, not a Lama, yet still he was considered as an elder because of his age, his travels, and his experience. "Tea, boy, tea," he exclaimed. "We will have tea, for the flesh is frail and the weight of the years press heavily upon me. Tea for the young and for the old." In response to his summons, a monk attendant to the aged brought us tea and barley. We mixed our sampa and settled down, he to talk and I to listen. The Lord Abbot gave me permission to leave Shakpuri and enter a hermitage. With the monk attendant, I traveled from this place and ascended into the mountains. After 5 days of travel, we reached a spot which may be discerned from the roof above us. I nodded. I knew the place, a solitary building set high in the Himalayas. The old man continued, "This place was empty. The former occupant had recently died. The attendant and I cleaned out the place, then I stood and looked out across the valley of Lhasa for the last time. I looked down at the Patala and at Shakyamuni, then turned and went into the inner chamber. The attendant walled up the door, cementing it firmly, and I was alone." "But, sir, what is it like inside?" I asked. Old Wu Si rubbed his head. "It's a stone building," he replied slowly. "A building with very thick walls. There is no door. Once one is inside the inner chamber, the doorway is walled up. In the wall there is a trap entirely light-proof, through which the hermit receives food. A dark tunnel connects the inner chamber with the room wherein the attendant lives. I was walled in. The darkness was so thick that I could almost feel it. Not a glimmer of light entered, nor could any sound be heard. I sat upon the floor and began my meditation. First, I suffered from hallucinations, imagining that I saw streaks and bands of light. Then, I felt the darkness strangling me as if I were covered in soft, dry mud. Time ceased to exist. Soon, I heard, in my imagination, bells and gongs and the sound of men chanting. Later, I beat against the constraining walls of my cell, trying in my frenzy to force a way out. I knew not the difference between day or night, for here all was as black and as silent as a grave. After some time, I grew calm. My panic subsided. I sat and visualized the scene. Old Wu Si, young Wu Si then, in the almost living darkness, within the all-pervading silence. "Every 2 days," said the old man, "the attendant would come and place a little sampa outside the trap. Come so silently that I could never hear him. The first time, feeling blindly for my food in the darkness, I knocked it off and couldn't reach it. I called and screamed, but no sound escaped from my cell. I just had to wait for another 2 days." "Sir," I asked, "what happens if a hermit is ill or dies?" "My boy," said the old Wu Si, "if a hermit is ill, he dies. The attendant places food every 2 days for 14 days. After 14 days, if the food is still untouched, men come and break down the wall and take out the body of the hermit." Old Wu Si had been a hermit for 7 years. "What happens in a case like yours when you have stayed for the time decided upon?"
"I stayed for 2 years and then for 7. When it was almost time for me to come out, the smallest of small holes was made in the ceiling so that a very minute shaft of life entered. Every 2 days of the hole was enlarged, permitting more light to enter. At last I could withstand the full light of day. If the hermit is suddenly brought out into the light, he's immediately struck blind as his eyes have been so long dilated in the darkness that they can no longer contract. When I came out, I was white, bleached white, and my hair was as white as the mountain snow. I had massage and did exercise, for my muscles were almost useless with disuse. Gradually I recovered my strength, until at last I was able with my attendant to descend the mountain, to reside again at Shakpori. I pondered his words, thinking of the endless years of darkness, of utter silence, thrown upon his own resources, and I wondered, "What did you learn from it, sir? Was it worth it?" "Yes, boy, yes, it was worth it," said the old monk. "I learned the nature of life. I learned the purpose of the brain. I became free of the body and could send my spirit soaring afar, just as you do now in the astral." "But how do you know that you did not imagine it? How do you know that you were sane? Why would you not travel in the astral as I do?" Wu Zi laughed till the tears rolled down his furrowed cheeks. "Questions, questions, questions, boy, just as I used to ask them," he replied. "First, I overcame my panic. I cursed the day I became a monk, cursed the day I entered the cell. Gradually, I was able to follow the breathing patterns and to meditate. At the start, I had hallucinations, vain imaginings. Then one day I slipped free of my body, and the darkness was dark no more to me. I saw my body sitting in the attitude of meditation. I saw my sightless, staring, wide-open eyes. I saw the pallor of my skin and the thinness of my body. Rising, I passed through the roof of the cell and saw below me the valley of Lhasa. I saw certain alterations, saw people with whom I was acquainted, and passing into the temple, I was able to converse with the telepathic Lama, who confirmed my release for me. I wandered far and wide and beyond the borders of this country. Every 2 days I returned and entered my body, reanimating it that I might eat and nourish it." "But why could you not do astral traveling without all that preparation?" I asked again. "Some of us are very ordinary mortals. Few of us have the special ability given to you by virtue of the task you have to undertake. You too have traveled far by the astral way. Others, such as I, have to endure solitude and hardship before one's spirit can break free from the flesh. You, boy, are one of the fortunate ones, one of the very fortunate ones." The old man sighed and said, "Go, I must rest, I have talked long. Come and see me again, you will be a welcome visitor, in spite of your questions." He turned away, and with a muttered word of thanks, I rose to my feet, bowed, and slipped quietly from the room. I was so busy thinking that I walked straight into the opposite wall, almost knocked my spirit out of my body. Rubbing my aching head, I walked sedately along the corridor until I reached my own cell. The midnight service was almost over. Monks were fidgeting slightly, ready to hurry off for a few more hours of sleep before returning. The old reader up on the podium carefully inserted a marker between the pages of the book and turned in readiness to step down. Sharp-eyed proctors, ever alert for disturbances or for inattentive small boys, relaxed their gaze. The service was almost over. Small cellas swung the censers for the last pass, and there was the barely suppressed hum of a large gathering preparing to move. Suddenly there was an ear-splitting screech, and a wild figure bounded over the heads of the sitting monks and tried to seize a young trapper holding two sticks of incense. We jerked upright with shock. Before us the wild figure whirled and spun, foam flying from writhing lips, hideous screams pouring from tortured throat. For a moment of time the world seemed to stand still, police monks frozen into immobility with surprise, officiating priests standing with arms upraised. Then, violently, the proctors swung into action. Converging on the mad figure, they quickly subdued him, winding his robe about his head to silence the evil oaths which streamed in a torrent from his mouth. Efficiently, speedily, he was lifted and removed from the temple. The service ended. We rose to our feet and hastened out, anxious to get beyond the temple bounds so that we could discuss what we had just seen. "That's Kenji Takuchi," said a young trapper near me. "He's a Japanese monk who's been visiting everywhere. Been around the world, so they say," added another. "Searching for truth, hoping to get it handed to him instead of working for it," remarked a third. I wandered off, somewhat troubled in mind. Why should searching for truth make a man mad? The room was cold and I shivered slightly as I wrapped my robe around me and lay down to sleep. It seemed that no time at all had elapsed before the gongs were booming again for the next service. As I looked through the window, I saw the first rays of the sun come over the mountains, rays of light like giant fingers probing the sky, reaching for the stars. I sighed and hurried down the corridor, anxious not to be the last one to enter the temple and thus merit the wrath of the proctors. "You are looking thoughtful, Lobsang," said my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup, when I saw him later in the day after the noon service. He motioned for me to sit. "You saw the Japanese monk Kenji Takuchi when he entered the temple. I want to tell you about him, for later you will meet him." I settled myself more comfortably. This was not going to be a quick session. I was caught for the rest of the day. The Lama smiled as he saw my expression. "Perhaps we should have Indian tea and Indian sweet cakes to sugar the pill, eh, Lobsang?" I brightened up a bit and he chuckled and said, "The attendant is bringing it now. I expected you." Yes, I thought as the monk servant entered, where else would I have such a teacher? The cakes from India were my special favorites, and even the lama's eyes sometimes widened with astonishment at the number I could put away. Kenji Takuchi, said my guide, was a very versatile man, a well-traveled one. Throughout his life, he's now over 70, he has wandered the world in search of what he calls truth. Truth is within him, yet he knows it not. Instead, he's wandered and wandered again. Always he's been studying religious beliefs. Always he's been reading the books of many lands in pursuit of this search, this obsession. Now, at long last, he's been sent to us. He's read so much of a conflicting nature that his aura is contaminated. He's read so much and understood so little that most of the time he's insane. He is a human sponge, mopping up all knowledge and digesting very little. Then, sir, I exclaimed, you are opposed to book study? Not at all, Lobsang, replied the Lama. I'm opposed, as are all thinking men, to those who obtain the brochures, the pamphlets, the books written about strange cults, about so-called occultism. These people poison their soul. They make further progress impossible for them until they have shed all the false knowledge and become as a little child. Honorable Lama, I asked, how does one become insane? How does wrong reading sometimes lead to confusion? That is quite a long story, replied the Lama Mingyar Dondup. First, we have to deal with some fundamentals. Possess yourself in patience and listen. Upon earth, we are as puppets, puppets made of vibrating molecules, surrounded by an electric charge. Our overself vibrates at a very much higher rate and has a very much higher electric charge. There is a definite relationship between our rate of vibration and that of our overself. One can liken the process of communication between each one of us on this earth and our overself elsewhere to a new process on this world, the process whereby radio waves are sent across continents and seas, thus enabling a person in one country to communicate with the person in a far distant land. Our brains are similar to radio receivers in that they receive the high-frequency messages, orders, and instructions from the Overself and turn them into low-frequency impulses which control our actions. The brain is the electromechanical chemical device which makes us useful on Earth. Chemical reactions cause our brain to function in a faulty manner by perhaps blocking part of the message, for rarely on Earth do we receive the exact message broadcast by the Overself. The mind is capable of limited action without reference to the Overself. The mind is able to accept certain responsibilities, form certain opinions, end, attempts to bridge the gap between the ideal conditions of the Overself and the difficult ones of Earth. But do Western people accept the theory of electricity in the brain? I asked. Yes, replied my guide. In certain hospitals, the brain waves of patients are charted, and it has been found that certain mental disorders have a characteristic brain wave pattern. Thus, from the brain waves, it can be stated that a person does or does not suffer from some mental disease or illness. Often, an illness of the body will send certain chemicals to the brain, contaminate its waveform, and thus give symptoms of insanity. Is the Japanese very mad? I asked. Come, we will see him now. He's had one of his lucid spells. The Lama, Mingyur Dandup, rose to his feet and hurried from the room. I jumped to my feet and sped after him. He led the way on down the corridor, down to another level, and to a distant wing where lodged those undergoing medical treatment. In a little alcove overlooking the Kati Linga, the Japanese monk sat, looking moodily outwards. At the approach of the Lama Mingyur Dandup, he rose to his feet, clasped his hands, and bowed low. Be seated, said my guide. I have brought a young man to you that he may listen to your words. He's under special instruction by order of the Inmost One. The Lama bowed, turned, and left the alcove. For some moments the Japanese stared at me, then motioned for me to sit. I sat, but at a discreet distance, as I did not know when he would become violent. Do not cram your head with all the occult stuff you read, boy, said the Japanese monk. It is indigestible matter which will impede your spiritual progress. I studied all the religions. I studied all the metaphysical cults which I could find. It poisoned me, clouded my outlook, led me to believe that I was specially chosen one. Now my brain is impaired and at times I lose control of myself, escape from the direction of my Overself. But, sir, I exclaimed, how may one learn if one may not read? What possible harm can come of the printed word? Boy, said the Japanese monk, certainly one may read, but choose with care what you read, and make sure that you quite understand what you are reading. There is no danger in the printed word, but there is danger in the thoughts with which those words may cause. One should not eat everything, mixing the compatible with the incompatible, nor should one read things which contradict or oppose others. Nor should one read things which promise occult powers. It is easily possible to make a thought form which one cannot control, as I did, and then the form injures one. Have you been to all the countries of the world? I asked. The Japanese looked at me, and a slight twinkle appeared in his eyes. I was born in a small Japanese village, he said, and when I was old enough, I entered holy service. For years, I studied religions and occult practices. Then my superior told me to leave and to travel in countries far beyond the oceans. For 50 years I've traveled from country to country, from continent to continent, always studying. By my thoughts I have created powers which I could not control. Powers that lived in the astral plane and which at times affect my silver cord. Later, maybe, I shall be permitted to tell you more. For the present, I'm still weak from the last attack, and thus I must rest. With the permission of your guide, you may visit me at a later date. I made my bows and left him alone in the alcove. A medical monk, seeing me leave, hastened in to see him. Curiously, I peeped about me, peeped at the old monks lying there in this part of the Shakpori. Then, in response to an urgent telepathic call, I hastened away to my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup. End of chapter 4.